Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 145. Some True History, Part 1. Show featuring an Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. So take a breather, take a break from all that election yada yada, and read some real history, study some history, see the background to all the yada yada. Again, check out, an interview with Green Party candidate Jill Stein on a show called Empire Files with Abby Martin. She talks some smart stuff. But meanwhile, this show will go back in time to show you some of what's affecting now and how we can think about ways to remedy and be peaceful. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening.
I'm about halfway through, so I'll do, part one of Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published by Beacon Press out of Boston. Beacon's Press Revisioning American History series consists of accessible books written by notable scholars that reconstruct and reinterpret U.S. history from diverse perspectives. Interestingly, Beacon Press books are published under the auspices of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. Book modeled after Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which I've read some of, and in a nutshell gives history told, as the title shows, from the people's perspective, individuals, native peoples, blacks, slaves, various immigrants, minorities, common man, worker types. So, it took me a while in life to sort of get into history, I think, in part because of how it's presented, often presented as dry and impersonal. And so it takes someone like Howard Zinn to make it interesting. And then again, a lot of propaganda and illusions being revealed in Dunbar Ortiz's book. One phrase that stands out is settler colonialism and settler rangers. Some of the more high-profile sports teams have been under question, like Washington Redskins, but from reading this book, there's a small section about what the Texas Rangers were actually doing, so that name is now on the list of names to change, as well as the San Francisco 49ers as gold. What they were going for was gold, despite who was in their path. So a lot of interesting info. And let's see, in the author's note, she throws out some phrases: colonization, dispossession, settler colonialism, genocide. These are the terms that drill to the core of U.S. history, to the very source of the country's existence. Now, part of what the section I was just reading, it just flat out clearly shows that, annihilation, eradication of peoples is one of the main agendas. So to even discuss, quote, U.S. democracy, you have to look beyond that, just the blind verbiage to the realities. One of the first things that impressed me in the section called Follow the Corn is the large gardens, systems of roadways, and advanced agriculture. And that, we tend to have these stereotypical ideas of Native peoples 500 years ago and, living in their little villages and picking berries off the plants and hunting food, perhaps, and et cetera, et cetera. But, there's a whole network of whatever levels, travel, commerce, spirituality, connecting in at least in Turtle Island, North America. And it shows a fascinating level of organization and, quote, civilized behavior. She says, societies in the eastern part of the continent had an elaborate ceremonial structure for diplomatic meetings among representatives of disparate governments. And a bit that I found most fascinating and have put into my book that I'm working on about the Constitution here. Here it is, the Haudenosaunee Constitution, called the Great Law of Peace, that inspired essential elements of the U.S. Constitution. Orrin Lyons, who holds the title of Faith Keeper of the Turtle Clan and is a member of the Onondaga Council of Chiefs, explains the essence of that Constitution. The first principle is peace. Second principle, equity, justice for the people. And third, the power of the good minds, of the collective powers to be of one mind, unity, and health. All of these were involved in the basic principles and the process of discussion, putting aside warfare as a method of reaching decisions and now using intellect. So right there, you can see some major discrepancies with what the U.S. has gone on and people tout as the great experiment in democracy. And yet, in virtually every election I've ever seen of most significance has had a 51-49 victory. So, where's the one mind? It's no wonder that there's much schizo-ness going on. An interesting bit here: the Muscogees, Creeks, Seminoles, and other peoples in the Southeast had three branches of government: a civil administration, a military, and a branch that dealt with the sacred. So those are key things lacking in today's world, and part of why the U.S. Spins its wheels. And another fascinating bit, I might have done this already, I don't know. In the rare cases in which consensus could not be reached, the segment of the community represented by dissenters might withdraw from the community and move away to found a new community. This was similar to the practice of the nearly 100 autonomous towns of northern New Mexico. So, again, a sort of practical and responsible and non-confrontatory way of resolving problems. If people didn't get along, they just started, they went somewhere else and did their thing. And again, the first chapter, Follow the Corn, a nice little riff on the Watergate, Follow the Money. And she She traces some of that. The sacredness, the first great cultivators of corn were the Mayans, initially centered in present-day northern Guatemala and the Mexican state of Tabasco. Extending the Yucatan Peninsula, the Mayans of the 10th century built city-states, Chichen Itza, Mayapan, Uxmal, and many others, as far as south as Belize and Honduras. So that goes on. And then, of course, you have a lot of the nations of the Southwest. Corn as sacred, and corn, beans, and squash, the three sisters. And you fast forward and you look at today's world, where the sacredness of the corn, which he mentions interestingly, has to have a lot of human attention. Unlike most grains, corn cannot grow wild and cannot exist without attentive human care. So it shows the interrelation. But the corn, we think of the South, the Midwest as the Corn Belt. And meanwhile, last I checked, it was like supermarket products nowadays have like 75% of them, percent of the them have corn products, and there's a real good chance that a lot of that corn is genetically modified. So it's one of these crop relations that is showing us where the consciousness has taken it from a sacred respect to a scientific, piece of lab stuff. So there's a lot that could be said about that. Anyway, another Cherokee writer, Robert Conley, tells about the oral tradition that claims Cherokee origins in South America and subsequent migration through Mexico. And a green corn dance, corn woman. So again, the corn is not just a food; it's connected with the culture and the spirituality. Chapter 2 goes on to culture of conquest. Mentions the 11th through 13th centuries crusades to conquer North Africa and the Middle East. In Western Europe, those were the Crusades, literally carrying of the cross, that was brought over to Turtle Island and started the craziness. See, white supremacy and class. This section, also part of the Christian colonizers' outlook, was a belief in white supremacy, as in 1878 U.S. Protestant evangelical hymn suggests, "Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are they washed in the blood of the Lamb?" Whiteness as an ideology involves much more than skin color, although skin color has been and continues to be a key component of racism in the U.S. White supremacy can be traced to the colonizing ventures of the Christian Crusades in Muslim-controlled territories and to the Protestant colonization of Ireland. As dress rehearsals for the colonization of the Americas, these projects form the two strands that merge in the geopolitical and sociocultural makeup of U.S. society. The Crusades in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, and Portugal today, and expulsion of Jews and Muslims were part of the process that created the core ideology for modern colonialism, white supremacy, and its justification for genocide. And it gets into the doctrine of Christian discovery, which has a whole chapter at the haven't read yet, towards the latter part of the book. And again, other examples throughout the world during the same period. The Portuguese, in which period this is, 1500s, I think, the Portuguese laid waste to what is today Brazil and began a thriving slave trade that would funnel millions of enslaved Africans to South America, beginning the lucrative Atlantic slave trade. Of course, Galeano's Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, Open Veins of Latin America comes to mind. The first time in human history, the majority of Europeans depended for their livelihood on a small, wealthy minority. A phenomenon that capitalist-based colonialism would spread worldwide. The symbol of this new development, indeed, its currency was gold. Gold fever drove colonizing ventures organized at first in pursuit of the metal in its raw form. And on and on. And then another chapter 3, the cult of the covenant. Gets into the various European religions that sort of spawned this supremacy view, and the land, very key element here. Founders of the North American colonies and later of the United States had a similar sense of a providential opportunity to make history. Indeed, as Atkinson reminds us, it is from the scriptures that Western society learned how to think historically. The key moment in history, according to Covenant ideology, involves the winning of the land from alien and indeed evil forces, end quote. So again, the whole racist, biased, theo-fascist mode that's been around for a while. And she gets into just showing some of the lineages of the, let's see, descendants of the English Pilgrims, Scots, Irish, and the Huguenot French, Calvinists all, who took the land bequeathed to them in the sacred covenant that predated the creation of the independent United States. These were the settlers who fought their way over the Appalachians into the fertile Ohio Valley region, and it is they who claimed blood sacrifice for their country. Immigrants, to be accepted, must prove their fidelity to the covenant and what it stands for. And she's got settler colonialism and the Ulster Scots, a section, the core group of frontier settlers were the Ulster Scots, the Scots-Irish, or Scotch-Irish, as they called themselves. The ancestors, descendants of these Scots-Irish say their ancestors came to the British colonies from Ireland, but their journey was more circuitous than that. The Scots-Irish were Protestants from Scotland who were recruited by the British as settlers in the six counties of the province of Ulster in Northern Ireland. The British had seized these 500,000 acres from Ireland in the early 17th century, driven the indigenous Irish farmers from it, and opened it to settlement under English protection. This coincided with the English plantation of two colonies in the Atlantic coast of North America and the beginning of settler colonialism there. These early settlers came mostly from the Scottish lowlands. Scotland itself, along with Wales, had preceded Ireland as colonial notches in the belt of English expansion. Britain's colonization of indigenous lands in North America was foreshadowed by its colonization of Northern Ireland. By 1630, the new settlers in Ulster, 21,000 Britons, B-R-I-T-O-N-S, including some Welsh, and 150,000 lowland Scots, were more numerous than British settlers in all of North America at the time. In 1641, the indigenous Irish rebelled and killed 10,000 of the settlers, yet Protestant Scots settlers continued to pour in. In some formerly Irish areas, they formed a majority of the population. They brought with them the covenant ideology of Calvinism that had been the work of the Scotsman John Knox. Later, John Locke, also a Scot, would secularize the covenant idea into a, quote, contract, the social contract, whereby individuals sacrificed their liberty only through consent. An insidiously effective example, the U.S. economic system was based on Locke's theories. The Scots-Irish were the foot soldiers of the British Empire building. Chapter 4, Bloody Footprints. So as I find when I read other various books, it expands the awareness of who is doing what, you know, the different people. Like, here's an example. Commander Montgomery was well aware that even with irregular warfare, the military could not defeat the Cherokees in their own country, and that he would need settlers and indigenous allies serving as scouts and guides. He added to his troop strength 300 settler rangers, 40 local militia members, and 50 Catawba allies. The Cherokee Nation had not succeeded in forming a confederation with the Muscogees or Chickasaws, so their villages were vulnerable. So that's, you know, the book shows various settlers and rangers, local militia, different people with different agendas, sometimes the white poor or the blacks. The Buffalo Soldiers were blacks used to fight around the Civil War time, where blacks were used to fight and take over the indigenous land. So there's a lot more. The more I read of history, the more I see the hodgepodge mix of who's doing what and for various reasons. And, you know, sometimes say she mentions the blacks did not have, you know, there wasn't the internet back then. They did not know exactly what was going on in the bigger picture, so they may have been taking jobs to get some money or whatever. And then she mentions Britain's victory at the end of the French and Indian War in 1763 led to English domination of world trade, sea power, and colonial holdings for a century and a half. In the Treaty of Paris, 1763, France ceded Canada and all claims east of the Mississippi to Britain. English settlers had gained strength in numbers and security in relation to indigenous peoples just outside the British-occupied colonies. French and Indian War would later be seen as the trigger for independence of the settler population, in which the distinctly American nation was born.
This mythology was expressed in the 1826 novel The Last of the Mohicans, in which the author, land speculator James Fenimore Cooper, created a usable settler colonial history. She also has a chapter, sort of, if you're an American literature major, she will justifiably bash some of your favorites, including, say, Whitman and various others. And here's a sort of, if you study some history, you see, like, the treatment of Native Americans, Native peoples, is sort of the blueprint going into Iraq. Let's see here. She's talking about Dunmore's War pushed the Shawnees into an alliance with the British against the separatists in 1777. Indigenous warriors struck scattered squatter settlements throughout the Upper Ohio Valley region, driving hundreds of settlers from Shawnee territory. But the tide of war between the British and the separatists turned, allowing the Continental Congress to focus on the Ohio country and organize an offensive to annihilate the Shawnee nation. 500 separatist fighters composed of both militiamen and regulars waged a genocidal war, rampaging against combatants and non-combatants alike. The Ranger force fell on the staunchly neutral towns of the Delaware Nation, torturing and killing women and children. So some of the fracturing and balkanization that we're seeing in Iraq, you know, this book shows how things that are happening today are maybe I'm oversimplifying, but the sort of prime directive of the insanity has been on the books for hundreds of years, which again is why a lot of Native peoples are mentioning that this age of the Pacha is after 500 years of such traumas, and that there is a waking up and a healing from all this. So that's the positive side. And, a testament to the Native people's resilience, she writes, without the culture of resistance, surviving indigenous people under U.S. colonization would have been eliminated through individual assimilation. So, you know, a lot of times in conversation, you hear people say, oh, it's terrible what we did to the Indians. And, you know, instead of also, you know, yes, and instead of looking at what's terrible going on now, and also looking at, wow, isn't it amazing what an amazing people they are, that they survive and you know, some are beginning to flourish and reawaken the awareness of their culture. So let's focus on the positives as well. And, you know, the other angle of the whole settler colonialism here, she expresses in Second Amendment ratified in 1791 enshrined these irregular forces into law. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The continuing significance of that freedom specified in the Bill of Rights reveals the settler colonialist cultural roots of the United States that appear even in the present as a sacred right. Here's the beginning of that point. Although not mentioned as such, Native peoples are implied in the Second Amendment. Male settlers have been required in the colonies to serve in militias during their lifetimes for the purpose of raiding and raising indigenous communities. The southern colonies included, and later states, militias were used as slave patrols. So that is rarely ever, I don't think I've heard that brought up in the whole right to bear arms thing. That's, you know, some of the roots of that are that the right to bear arms had to do with a supremacist outlook. And, here you have again another line that shows where things have been from the get-go. Washington's administration determined that only war, not diplomacy, would break up the indigenous alliances. And one horrible example that reminded me of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where it was said that the U.S. knew that Japan was already going to surrender, so there was no need to drop the bombs. So this is around, the Shawnee leader, Blue Jacket, refused submission, and the U.S. forces began destroying Shawnee villages and fields and murdering women, children, and old men. On August 20th, 1794, at Fallen Timbers, the main Shawnee fighting force was overpowered. Even after this U.S. victory, the Rangers continued for 3 days laying waste to Shawnee houses and cornfields, creating a 50-mile swath of devastation.
So it just the book really highlights his sort of violent, you know, insane, bigoted, whatever other adjectives you want to put on it, this whole, you know, sickness of imperialism and empire and all the stuff that's caught up with it. And then you have a area section where settlers at odds with federal government then working together. So again, there's various factions of people. Here's the example. In squatter settlements, ruthless leaders like Sevier were not the exception but the rule. Once they had full control and got what they wanted, they made their peace with the federal government, which in turn depended on their actions to expand the republic's territory. So you have this federal government thing going on in the whatever various settlers, or I guess some of that sort of you know, Wild West independent streak of the sort of stereotypical American. And you know, the combination of finance and military here, this method of colonization by co-optation and debt proved effective wherever employed by colonial powers in the world, but only when it was accompanied by extreme violence at any sign of indigenous insurgency. And counterinsurgency, the U.S. leaders brought counterinsurgency out of the pre-independence period into the new republic, imprinting on the fledgling federal army a way of war with formidable consequences for the continent and the world. Counterinsurgent warfare and ethnic cleansing targeting indigenous civilians continue to define U.S. war making throughout the 19th century, with markers such as the three U.S. counterinsurgent wars against the Seminoles through the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864 to Wounded Knee in 1890. In the Civil War, these methods played a prominent role on both sides. Confederate regular forces, Confederate guerrillas such as William Quantrill and General Sherman for the Union, all engaged in waging total war against civilians. The pattern would continue in U.S. military inventions overseas, from the Philippines and Cuba to Central America, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The cumulative effect goes beyond simply the habitual use of military means and becomes the very basis for U.S. American identity. The Indian fighting frontiersmen and the valiant settlers in their circled covered wagons are the iconic images of that identity. The continued popularity of and respect for the genocidal sociopath Andrew Jackson is another indicator. Actual men such as Robert Rogers, Daniel Boone, John Sevier, and David Crockett, as well as fictitious ones created by James Fenimore Cooper and other best-selling writers, call to mind D.H. Lawrence's, quote, myth of the essential white American, end quote, that the essential American soul is a killer. So that is quite a statement. It takes some soul searching to look at that, and that's up through chapter 5. And then it gets into the last of the Mohicans and Andrew Jackson's White Republic. Andrew Jackson, who adorns, rather disgraces, the $20 bill. I mean, what does that say about our monetary system that a genocidal sociopath is on the most common bill, if you consider the ATM machines that spit out 20s like buckshot, that is sort of the main, you know, the main bill nowadays, I would say. And his face is on that is just is disgraceful. Well, that's 100 pages into the book, and so probably would take a few shows to get to this and the whole thing, so that's okay. And it gets into, just to give a quick overview, it gets into Jackson in the 1860s, and then gets into U.S. triumphalism and peacetime colonialism. Talks about what the phrase Indian country came from, and the ghost dance prophecy. The doctrine of discovery, and then there's a conclusionary chapter with some positive and optimistic notes. So it's, you know, generally it's a fascinating book. If you really want to get to the unspoken or heretofore unspoken roots of what's really going on with this ongoing conflict of energies of the United States and Turtle Island and the Native peoples, and how these various blueprints affect things worldwide. So yeah, a lot of intense stuff in the book, and worth the details if you're into that aspect of the history, and I would also suggest complementing it with, you know, some of the learning about the real culture and traditions of the people to see what the, you know, put the history in context. And we'll go out with a little piece that I just found on YouTube. It's called Celebrate Love, Celebrate Life, Honoring John Trudell. This is a little tribute by his bandmates. It's just beautifully done.
Oh,